This recording is the property of the Winter-Gren Foundation and cannot be used, quoted, transcribed, or otherwise rebroadcast without the express permission of the Foundation. This is New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section Lecture Series for April 28, 2014, featuring Sarah K. Croucher and Capitalism and Cloves.
Oh, you'll hear me now. Okay. Okay, thanks for coming along, everyone. I'll just repeat that. This is the final New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Division lecture of this academic year. We'd like to thank myself and Janice Sodikoff, my co-chair. We'd like to thank the Winter-Gren for their gracious hosting, as always, in these lovely surroundings. Thank you. Apologies from Leslie Aiello, who can't be here tonight. But I will, as has become tradition, repeat what she says. If you're drinking red wine, please take care of it. Don't spill it on the lovely light-coloured carpet, okay? Or you'll be cleaning it up afterwards. Yeah. Okay. So there should also be a sign-up sheet going around for anyone who would like to sign up for our mailing list on the listserv and so on. Okay, our speaker tonight, our guest tonight is Dr. Sarah Croucher. Sarah is Assistant Professor of Anthropology and Archaeology at Wesleyan University, and she's also core faculty member of the Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies program there at Wesleyan also. She's a historical archaeologist with a focus on the 19th century. She received her PhD from the University of Manchester in the UK in 2006, and this looked at the archaeology of clove plantations on 19th century Zanzibar. She's recently been developing this work, partly through a prestigious SAR research scholarship, 2010-11. And she's been developing this work to look at the differences between Islamic and European-run plantations in East Africa within the context of colonialism and capitalism. She's also working on the links between East Africa and Connecticut, looking at the 19th century ivory trade. In terms of her writings, as well as articles on gender and sexuality in 19th century East African contexts, in the volume The Archaeology of Colonialism, Intimate Encounters and Sexual Effects, 2011, she has also co-edited the 2011 Springer volume, The Archaeology of Capitalism in Colonial Contexts, Postcolonial Historical Archaeologies. And she's finishing off, I think, finished the book on which we're going to hear about tonight, Capitalism and Cloves, An Archaeology of Plantation Life on 19th Century Zanzibar. Please welcome Dr. Sarah Croucher. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Brian, and thank you so much for inviting me. It's lovely to be here. So I'm going to begin with this quote. I can do a good British colonial voice. I have the right accent for it. So, from the sea, the island Zanzibar presents the appearance of an unbroken forest of coconut, mango, and other trees, with the clove plantations on the hills forming the background. The island is intersected by paths and green lanes in every direction, affording a never-ending variety of pleasant rides and walks. The country houses of the Arab proprietors and the huts of their slaves are thickly dotted over the surface, surrounded with gardens and fields. And the hedgerows are formed covered with flowering creepers, chiefly varieties of jasmine and wild pea. The hedges are formed of a species of laurel, wild orange, lime, and other evergreens, and pineapples grow everywhere in profusion. In many parts are glades of undulating grassland of park-like appearance, dotted with gigantic mango trees. The ponds are covered with rushes and white and blue lilies, and the air is perfumed with the blossoms of the mango and clove. So wrote Lieutenant Colonel C.P. Rigby, consul and British agent at Zanzibar in 1861, laying out one potential gaze over the clove plantation landscape on the island of Zanzibar. The island depicted here is an African one, and yet the images evoked by Rigby are those in some ways of the English countryside. And I begin with this quote as it draws out the complex, layered, and multivalent approach to landscapes I want to address in this talk. There are many things that could be said about this particular visualization of Zanzibar. The links to the English countryside could draw us in towards a productive agrarian landscape, but they could also suggest an idyllic pastoral view, one in which capitalist production is rendered invisible. Rigby's view also helps us begin to understand the failures of British colonial enterprise on late 19th century Zanzibar, particularly in relation to colonial inabilities to transform clove plantations into British ideals of a productive agrarian landscape. These failures must be set against local practices and understandings of plantations. Here on Zanzibar, there was no contradiction between increased capitalist production and non-European understandings of owning and conceiving of land. However, British colonial officials failed to see this nuance. This talk is drawn from one chapter of my forthcoming book, as Brian mentioned, it's done. In production, it has been poor, which focuses on larger questions of plantation archaeology and the growing field of global historical archaeology. Clove plantations, as plantations, are a seemingly familiar site for historical archaeologists. But as they are located in East Africa, they are one of the of only a few non-European colonial contexts investigated by archaeologists working outside of the Atlantic world. The field of historical archaeology, as I engage with it here, broadly claims to examine the modern world. Various definitions exist, and it's not my intention to engage specifically with these today, but rather I'm interested in the way in which a move to global sites, those outside of the Atlantic world in particular, may allow us to trouble some of the taken-for-granted assumptions which are fundamental to the field of historic archaeology. In some ways, my work aims to provide a productive critique of the field of historic archaeology with the goal of producing post-colonial interpretive frameworks that will make interpretations of the global more broadly commensurable with the typical Atlantic context that form most of the field. Zanzibar matters for historical archaeologists interested in colonialism and capitalism, since the study of plantations here blurs the often assumed binaries between pre-capitalist and capitalist, and between European and colonized. In historical archaeology, there is usually also a clear temporal division underlying interpretations. Indigenous others are always forced into a different temporal space to Europeans and colonial rulers. Capitalism has long been a mainstay of historical archaeological research, ranging from British houses and enclosure through to industrialized urban centers. Plantations have long figured into this narrative as a stepping stone, places in which we can see capitalist production being manifest in particular spatial forms. And this framework means that capitalism remains tethered to the Atlantic world, only exerting effect on those outside of the main Euro-American centers of development. Global, that is, non-European sites, remain caught in pre-capitalist temporalities under European colonialism until even European colonialism allows them to become coeval with the modern world, and therefore an object of study. And although my focus today is the late 19th century and the frustrations of the British on Zanzibar, my aim is to illuminate what they were unable to see. I hope that by critiquing the British gaze on plantation landscapes, we archaeologists may also become more critical of what we see or don't see. Clove plantations, the focus of my discussion today, were unusual institutions. They were under Islamic colonial rule, and yet they were wholly based on capitalist production. So the islands of Zanzibar, as I'm sure many of you know, are part of the East African Swahili coast, an area that was home to a mercantile Islamic culture and indigenous African urbanism from around the 8th century AD. Until the mid-second millennium AD, the East African coast was ruled by local urban elites. And from the late 15th century, the Portuguese began to take control of the coast. But their rule was always weak, with few actual Portuguese ever present in this particular region. So following on from their aid in expelling the Portuguese from Mombasa, From the 17th and 18th century, the coast came loosely under the rule of the Gulf state of Oman. And this was quite patchy, and I won't go into it too much. But by the early 19th century, the southerly island of Zanzibar, also called Unguja, had become a colonial outpost of Oman, with significant numbers of Omani immigrants. So Omani interest in Zanzibar came first because the main city on the islands acted as an entrepot, through which wealth from caravan trading in ivory, which was going to Connecticut for the most part, slaves and other goods flowed. But an accident of geography and history meant that the tree crop of cloves came to dominate agrarian production on the islands, with Zanzibar becoming the single world's largest supplier of the spice by the end of the 19th century. So this fact alone should hint at the scale of transformation in the agrarian sector of Zanzibar during this period. The shift was not just one of what was being grown and where. Plantations were a social institution in that they were the structure through which plantation residents came to understand their lives, their social positions, and to live out daily experiences. Slavery was central to these plantations, with most agricultural and domestic labor being carried out by enslaved persons with their origins in mainland East and East Central Africa. And these are caravan porters, but I'm being a bit loose with my images. Enslaved women were also present in roles as concubines, an uneasy position where they were a part of the household, officially freed when they gave birth to a child of their owner, while simultaneously remaining in relations of bondage to the men who had purchased them. Concubines, interestingly, were also the last group to be legally manumitted by the British. An abolition decree largely ended slavery under British pressure in 1897, but concubines had to wait until 1909 for a broadening of the decree that granted them freedom. So along with this influx of enslaved laborers, and I should add that enslaved people became the majority of the population of the islands during this period. So this really is a very radical population change. So along with this influx were plantation owners, the majority of whom were Omani immigrants. Plantation owners also took freeborn wives, some of whom came from Oman and some of whom were drawn from the ranks of elite East Africans. The indigenous Muslim Waswahili population also continued to live on the islands of Zanzibar, with some members of this elite also owning plantations. So previous histories of clove plantations, particularly those by Cooper and Sheriff, have shown them to be subject to the push and pull of global and Indian Ocean economic forces during the 19th century. Omanis responded to prices and markets offered by Indian Ocean trading networks. Clearly, Zanzibar was no isolated area. Clove plantations continued the early patterns of economic and social connections that Swahili society had drawn on for several hundred years previous. But this was not just continuity. Omani colonialism also saw the dawn of something new. Yet despite the fact that a radical overhaul of the agrarian economic sector had taken place, as I'll discuss further in this talk, Zanzibar in the late 19th century failed to match up to British colonial desires for capitalist production. A land tenure problem became one way in which this issue could be framed. If only agricultural production could become truly part of a modern capitalist economy with the legal framework required for capital to truly function, then Zanzibar could become more important and likely more attractive to Europeans within the larger framework of the British Empire. These questions of colonial desires literally mapped onto landscapes and the inability to comprehend already existing capitalism laid out in alternative understandings of landscape are the focus of my talk today. And as a quick note on methodology, my work is interdisciplinary. So I'm a historical archaeologist. I do actually dig things up, but I'm mostly going to talk about documentary history today. I also draw on oral histories, on landscape survey, on archival research, and I draw these together in my overall work. So although it's historical, I'll kind of mention some archaeology at the end, but it does kind of all come together in my work. So for those of you here who are historical archaeologists, the term plantation landscape likely sums up a fairly clear set of ideas. plantations of the large estate form, a utilization of a term in the English language which was first used to connote a colonial settlement, became established in Anglo-Caribbean colonies only during the late 17th century. These early plantations had a shifting nomenclature. For example, Drax Hall in Jamaica, founded circa 1690, was recorded in contemporary documents as both a sugar estate and a plantation. In North America, great estates, atypical showpiece plantations, began to be constructed in the Chesapeake and Carolinas in the early 18th century. Such plantations laid the groundwork for a transformation of the Anglo-American idea of the plantation, so that by the mid-18th century, as America lay on the cusp of declaring independence, the ideal plantation, and I quote from Vlach, was a large, tastefully appointed country estate belonging to a prominent gentleman. So by the time of the U.S. Civil War in the mid-19th century, plantations were established in the vocabulary of the nation at large as large commercial farms, largely utilizing slave labor and with an extensive literature discussing the ideal landscape form of a working plantation. And this is what was understood in the 19th century by most Americans and Europeans as a plantation. Whilst acknowledged to have their origins in the Mediterranean, plantations remain most readily associated with the Atlantic world. Scholars might acknowledge the fact that plantations had outliers in other areas, but the general definition of plantations, in historical archaeology at least, follows on from mainstream historical and anthropological studies and remains in the Atlantic, particularly in the Americas. East African plantations, established from the early 19th century, were known in the Swahili language as shamba, the same word connoting any form of farm. However, they were recognized by English-speaking commentators as belonging to a particular form, the plantation. For 19th century European visitors and early 20th century British colonial administrators, precise definitions were not required. They knew of plantation systems. These were operational in the Indian Ocean and other European colonies, growing rubber, sugar, coffee, and other crops. And they recognized clove plantations as such. In naming clove-growing operations on Zanzibar as plantations, no specific definition of capitalist production was being checked off by European commentators. What such historical descriptions and the continued use of the term in historical scholarship are referencing is the fact that clove plantations fit with a broad definition of what constitutes a specifically modern plantation. For example, Sir Richard Burton, viewing the islands of Zanzibar in the mid-19th century, found comparison between the Sultan's prim plantations and the coffee plantations of Brazil. There was a clearly defined vernacular notion of plantation understood by European colonial visitors within which Zanzibari clove plantations were recognized to fit. These definitions point to an abstractive form as defined by Trullo, and Trullo arguing that the majority of European-run plantations of the Caribbean didn't actually fit into an ideal type, suggested that we think of plantations in general terms broadly as, and I quote, a form of labor organization with the plantation defined as an agricultural enterprise distinguished by its massive use of coerced or semi-coerced labor, producing agricultural commodities for markets situated outside of the economy within which the plantation itself operates, end quote. Such a definition would clearly include clove plantations. So plantations do occupy a complicated place in the history of capitalism writ large, with many arguing that capitalism proper only came into existence with the advent of industrialization. Skipping over these debates to a certain degree, I want to focus on some of the material shifts towards capitalism which have been acknowledged to be embedded in plantation landscapes. Prior to plantations, at the heart of the rural transition to capitalism in Europe, in early modern Europe, was the process of individuals coming to own land in segments that could be mapped out on paper. For capitalist exchange to work, plots of land and hours of labor had to be clear units so that they could become monetary values. Enclosure did not simply entail erecting new hedgerows and fences that delineated the land, but as a varied and long-term historical event, was also about the alteration of legal and customary rights to land, as well as new ways of envisaging this land as an alienated commodity. Transitions to capitalism and modernity were not monolithic, but the capitalist conceptions of landscape, where specific areas were owned, were at the heart of the landscape of plantations. And by the 18th century, planters could find sources which guided them to rationally ordered landscapes, further developing the idea of plantations as alienable spaces. In part, these guides were driven by new ways of organizing labor, tied in to a new capitalist order. So on Jamaica, for instance, in 1798, planters could examine Pierre-Joseph Laborie's guide, The Coffee Planter of Saint Domingo, to visualize an idealized coffee plantation landscape. Coffee planters were advised to lay their plantation out on a symmetrical grid plan, with domestic and industrial spaces in the geographic center, pastures and provision grounds to be laid out near the settlements. Sugar planters from 1823 could follow Thomas Ruffley's Jamaica Planter's Guide, another practical manual suggesting placement for various features, including that overseers' houses should have a clear view of all the works buildings and the slave hospital. So Dennis Cosgrove has seminally argued that from the 15th century onward, a new idea of landscape developed, first in Europe and then in North America, drawing heavily on new visual ideologies. Jamaican plantation maps such as these were often to be gazed on by absent plantation owners who could gain a sense that they could actually see the landscape that they owned and controlled. This vision was part of a new gaze, a way of seeing reduced to one point of view, usually that of a man of European origin. New geometric, linear, and uniform ways of seeing became accepted within a particular form of what Martin Jay has termed a scopic regime of modernity. In this concern with visualizing, the scopic regime of Cartesian perspectivalism facilitated capitalism. It's quite a tongue twister. As Jay has argued, and I quote, separate from the painter and the viewer, the visual field depicted on the other side of the canvas or map could become a portable commodity, able to enter the circulation of capitalist exchange. So this view was empirically oriented, seeking to fix knowledge into visual forms. Plantations in their capitalist form were entities embedded in hegemonic European conceptions of landscapes. By the late 18th century, European planters could increasingly turn to guidance which assumed that they were part of a singular scopic regime of Cartesian perspectivalism, which would encourage them toward particular ways of laying out their productive enterprise. As seen by plantation owners, the landscape was understood through the gaze. Plantation owners were disembodied from their landholdings, which were laid out in measurable units on paper, contiguous with the logics of capitalism. So these shifts were also tied to the practices of cartography. The act of enclosure in Britain from the 15th century, this crucial period of developing agrarian capitalism, was assisted by techniques of surveying and the production of local maps. The development of the modern nation state was also tied to changing forms of mapping. Individuals were able to visualize themselves as part of the territory of the nation state through new cartographic visualizations, which emphasized modern forms of power, reshaping mental structures and material processes. Maps were also crucial in the expansion of European power and the control and subjugation of indigenous populations. To make a real territory of colonial rule required a visual representation of a geographic whole. Maps were a form of geographic panopticon, forming a kind of all-seeing eye over colonial territories and facilitating the state's discipline and surveillance of their territories, and forming a gaze through which colonial desire could operate. Visualizing landscape within scopic regimes of Cartesian perspectivalism and making various scales and maps of maps and plans were vital to the technology of plantations in general. By the 19th century, it was a given that Euro-American plantations would be planned out in some form. They would exist on paper, an essential corollary to their spatial reality for the plantation owner, even if this was an idealized form of landscape far from the realities of everyday life within the space of the plantation itself. Power was expressed over space through the ability to visualize the land holdings of the plantation owner. Control of land was expressed through mapping. Reading British colonial archives on Zanzibar, it's clear that mapping plantation areas was a concern for several decades after the establishment of British colonial bureaucracy in the 1890s. Clove plantations had, until the close of the 19th century, lain outside of the gaze of Cartesian perspectivalism, despite their prominence in the global clove market. But by 1920, it was possible to list four different British-sanctioned projects for mapping Zanzibar in various ways, soon to be joined by another of Zanzibar in the 1930s. Our clearest window into the process of mapmaking as seen through British eyes comes from Captain John Craster, an employee of the Ordnance Survey, who came to head a small team producing a map of Pemba utilizing modern techniques of triangulation. His writing speaks of a landscape that he found wild, precisely for his lack of ability to gain an overall view of the land, the perspective that he so desperately wanted, and the impediments placed in his way by nature and islanders to a mapping project that appeared to have no relevance to any Zanzibaris. His depiction of the landscape contrasts sharply with the ordered images we see on the guides for European planters in the Caribbean. In his anecdotes of the 2 years he spent mapping the island, and he handily wrote a memoir of this time, which is good for me, he wrote of continually struggling through thick bush and having to make his way along generally the most villainous paths. One of his stories also seems to perfectly capture the manner in which local residents were easily making their way across a familiar landscape, but a landscape that was almost incomprehensible and far from orderly to the cartographer. He writes, "We had not gone far before we found ourselves descending a precipitous slope. The path became a mere rut in the slippery red clay on the hillside, and we kept our feet only by holding on to the lower branches of the trees. I thought the guide might have chosen a better path. But this is the only path," he exclaimed. "The cloves from all the plantations round about are brought to Wete by this path. So I scrambled down without further protest." What Craster could not find in rural Pemba was order of the type of rational planning that underlay European scopic regimes and landscape ideals. The colonial project of establishing sovereignty attempted to consolidate control in part by mastering and maneuvering through space, forcing areas to be remade in conformity with European spatial designs. Underlying the push towards mapping that resulted in Craster's wandering through Pemba, we can view a logic of ownership and a desire by the British for land to be more easily commodified. In 1912, the British administration on Zanzibar was working hard to draw up legislation and a framework for a full system of land titles, as I mentioned in my introduction. It was realized that this would be a massive undertaking, but some members of the British administration were hopeful that enacting such a plan would realize a fully capitalist working economy and would reap financial rewards. And there are kind of files and files of letters to and fro about the process of making maps. They hire a consultant. It's a long, drawn-out process. And views similar to those at play today, the simple availability of title deeds was seen to be vital to the functioning of free market economics, which could then propel landowners to greater prosperity. What was needed for Zanzibar was a policy to secure land title, lest Zanzibar not be, in the words of one administrator, a dying proposition. In the view of those who were not well acquainted with the actual desires of Zanzibari landowners, there was a clear need for cadastral survey of rural land at a scale that would allow for the production of title deeds to be tied in to an actual cartographic representation of land boundaries. Various survey schemes were suggested throughout the first 3 decades of the 20th century, but as with many urban schemes, these never came to fruition. The requirements of the colonial administration were understood to produce a desperate need for surveys that would go beyond the basic 1-inch-to-1-mile scale of Craster's map of Pemba and a similar topographic map of Zanzibar. Optimism was raised by the promulgation of a land title decree in 1915, which drew on legislative form from other areas of the British Empire. And there's a kind of correspondence circulating around at this time about how land title should be established in different areas. When this was drawn up and published, instructions were clear that all plantations were to be clearly marked with boundaries. These instructions suggested at least a modicum of hope that landowners would happily follow the cultural logics of landscape desired by the British. The decree spoke not to Zanzibaris, but to British colonial officials who were charged with taking action. And I quote from the 1915 decree. Having made yourself fully acquainted with the proposed policy, I am to request that you take every opportunity to explain carefully to the landowners of your district the intention of the government with regard to the delineation of estate boundaries. The success of the measure will largely depend on their cooperation. The temporary boundary marks are now on order in England, and pending their arrival, it's desirable not only, as explained above, to acquaint landowners with what's about to be undertaken, but also to prevail upon them to utilise the time which will elapse before the enforcement of the decree to decide upon the boundaries they propose to claim, and further, to come to some mutual arrangement with their respective neighbours as to any doubtful boundaries. At the same time, they should be urged especially to endeavour to agree to simplify crooked and irregular lines by mutual concession with each other. But this failed to have any effect on plantation areas, beyond very limited survey work by local assistant district commissioners, ADCs, who were lacking in skill and time to successfully survey land and place boundary markers. The ADCs did attempt to undertake some survey, apparently with some initial success in 1916, but the elaborate plans for boundary markers shipped in from England to be neatly placed along straight boundaries ultimately failed, in part because these straight boundaries didn't exist. The ADCs had only limited survey knowledge, and only a few holdings were ever marked out along their boundaries, and even fewer were turned into sketch plans. The climate of Zanzibar also conspired against them, with the much-touted boundary markers rotting and becoming lost within a single year. So, on Zanzibar, the cartographic process of British colonial rule from the late 19th century was complicated by the prior Omani regime. There was not always a sharp divide between Omanis and indigenous Waswahili, but nevertheless, many Omani planters had established their control on the islands only through their own takeover and control of space. And this is important, I think, to realise that in the context of these clove plantations, in many cases, authority was established by the fact that the plantation owner came along and took control of this land. When read carefully, what emerges clearly from the writings of the colonial administration is an alternate set of logics which governed ownership of land and its transfer. Craster realised that the work he understood to be absolutely vital was viewed in a different way by Zanzibaris. Discussing local Pemban residents, he commented that the notion that anyone should wish to have a map of the island, or that the map could be of any use when it was made, aside from the potential for the government to steal land, seemed to them absurd. The survey of Pemba also ran afoul of local residents sabotaging the survey by stealing vital beacons and other materials. A telegram sent by Craster to the authorities on Zanzibar outlined the issue of having had many survey beacons destroyed and flags and materials stolen, an issue he found to be quite urgent. Despite official backing from the British colonial authorities on the islands, Craster found villagers unhelpful, at times refusing to be clear on the naming of particular places, and there really seems to be a deep suspicion of this project by plantation owners in particular. These obstacles suggest a local population who were unwilling to aid in the cartographic project and saw no reason to assist the mixed British, Indian and African survey team. Producing commodities for export, and at least in the initial stages, making a profit in the process, clearly didn't entail a requirement that land should be planned out. The type of surveyor who thrived in plantation areas of Jamaica was seen by Zanzibaris to be working at an absurd task. Again and again, in discussions of survey work, reference is made to the antipathy of plantation owners to survey for the purpose of land titles. By the 1920s, the attempt to plan individual landowners' boundaries on an ad hoc basis was pretty much abandoned. So discussions of historical plantation owners by contemporary Zanzibaris also provide narratives that further flesh out the conceptualization of 19th century landholdings. While these have to be taken with caution, filtered through over 100 years of local historical change, they do provide some insights beyond the 19th and early 20th century records of Europeans. One site in the Mahonda region, Zanzibar, where stone foundation remains were visible, was associated with a plantation owner who clearly had a conception of the extent of his holdings. While not referring to land ownership, local residents recounted that the owner said of his holdings, "It cannot rain without raining on my shamba," that means a farm or plantation, since he owned plantations across a wide area on both Zanzibar and Pemba. This seems to clearly indicate that he had a clear sense of the size of his land holdings and that he projected social importance through these holdings, speaking of them boastfully. Turning back to historical documents, there are some further insights into the ways in which clove plantations and other holdings may have been clearly under ownership in terms other than those of Western capitalist norms. Part of this issue starts to emerge through the lamentation that trees were more important for plantation owners than the land on which they stood. Reporting on the survey of rural Zanzibari landholdings in 1923, senior surveyor of Zanzibar at the time, A.E. Adamson, I'm not sure there was a junior surveyor, wrote that when appointed to the post, he was, I quote, "under the impression that it was then intended to make a complete cadastral survey of the two islands and thus rectify the unfortunate position of the shamba owners in that at present they have no undisputed boundaries, or perhaps I should say undisputed boundaries to the land," this is in capitals, "on which their crops are growing, and therefore any property title they may be in possession of consists of trees only. The land is, I believe, in most cases actually marked by boundary trees, but these are not surveyed and relatively fixed, but their positions are supposed to be fixed only in the memories of the adjoining owners." Adamson appears to have been perceptive about these matters. In an earlier letter, also discussing the issue of land tenure on Zanzibar, he discussed what he understood to be widespread East African coastal norms. "At the present time, judging by what happens on the coastal belt, the ownership of land is accepted in most cases by the asserted ownership of certain trees, which he states are on the boundaries of his property. Planting of trees is going on continuously, and it often happens that a tree is planted over the boundary line between the two original terminal trees, and his line is therefore altered, encroaching on his neighbor's land and excising a portion therefrom. Several cases of this have occurred, and the adjudicator has been forced to give the ownership of the land to one person, but the ownership of trees to another." The logic of this system escaped Adamson and clearly drove him crazy. He thought that trees could only be owned if the land that they were growing on was legally owned prior to the planting of trees. Two systems of understanding how ownership could be apportioned appear to have clashed in these discussions of Zanzibari land tenure. Information from past anthropological studies of communities on Zanzibar and elsewhere along the Swahili coast also provide models for how land may have been understood, which fit with patterns identified by Adamson in the very early 20th century. John Middleton, for instance, suggests a very different formulation of land ownership and established patterns of land use on Zanzibar during the mid-20th century, which differed substantively from those developed under principles of capitalist enclosed agrarian production. Particular individuals, he says, could hold specific interests in parcels of land, and some trees were certainly held under the ownership of individuals. But land ownership, particularly in indigenous Swahili areas, often rested on shared group interests between various networks of persons. So, in the late 19th century, and then the 19th century in general, many plantation owners were newcomers. They were immigrants from Oman, influenced by cultural norms of their homeland. They were also part of the type of cosmopolitan socio-political climate of the 19th century Western Indian Ocean. If the fact that the original propagator of clove trees to Zanzibar, Saleh bin Haramil al-Arabe, doyen of the Omani merchant class, a man who was working as a translator for Europeans, is taken as an indicator, clove plantations did not simply emerge from Middle Eastern genealogies. East Africa in the 19th century was a cosmopolitan place, and it's important to realize that at least a segment of plantation owners may have been aware of the type of landscapes that dominated European colonial plantation regions, such as those of sugar planters on Mauritius. The enterprise of rapidly establishing investments in large plantation holdings seems to suggest a clear awareness of growing commodity trading in the Indian Ocean by the early 19th century, perhaps linked to the knowledge of the profits which could then be gained from the sale of ivory from caravan trading. Omani, Swahili, and European conceptions of productive agrarian landscapes might potentially have been drawn on in varying measures by Omani plantation owners. But as Omani planters initiated their agrarian spaces, there seems no evidence that their work began with mapping their landholdings. The vital step of establishing title and cartographic vision of a plantation space, as was so crucial elsewhere, seemed unimportant to the emergence of plantation owners in Eastern Africa. Instead, their work, or rather that of their slaves, started with the planting of trees. So local residents recall the 19th century Arab planter Abdallah bin Jabir at Mgoli, Pemba. As you can see in this image, and actually this building is kind of crumbling a little more, this was a sizable plantation, actually one of the largest recorded on my archaeological survey, and it was the target of excavations. And Abdallah bin Jabir is talked about by local residents today as having arrived at Mgoli sometime in the mid-19th century via Mombasa, and these dates seem to fit with the archaeological evidence, already owning many enslaved African laborers. Their first task was said to be laying out trees, which they did in careful straight lines, perhaps drawing on ideas from European landscapes. It's this action that potentially solidified Abdallah bin Jabir's control of these landholdings in the eyes of his Zanzibari neighbors. Placing boundary markers and having a title deed would have done nothing to solidify land ownership for this man. Within anthropological and historical discussions of East African norms, it's clear that the trees themselves, including clove trees, are able to be personal property, whereas land generally lies outside of clear individual ownership. By covering a very large area with clove trees, there seems to have been a route to establishing individual control over land. In placing their authority of ownership into a newly settled clove holdings, the tree crop nature of cloves may have helped to create Omani planters as effectively the owners of large tracts of land, which could then be passed on, and which the British colonial government was later to attempt, against the wishes of most Zanzibaris, to transfer into a different kind of cartographic reality. Despite this difference, I want to just very briefly mention spatial aspects of the plantation that seem perhaps to fit with the types of power relations we might see on European plantations of this period. Excavations to the front of the plantation owner's house at Mgoli revealed a clove drying floor, abutting a baraza. The baraza was a typical feature of Swahili houses, a public area where elite men could sit and talk. The clove drying floor was a particular feature of this type of plantation. When harvested, cloves must be laid out to dry, a laborious job, forming part of the intensive nature of the clove harvest. The location of the baraza, beside the clove drying floor, seems to suggest that the plantation owner was interested in observing enslaved labourers. Such features indicate that the spatial structure of power may have had certain affinities with European plantations, particularly in regard to observing enslaved labourers, and this is something that is understood to be particularly important in those kinds of planters' guides, in the way that different buildings were laid out so that labour could be observed. However, the clove drying floor also brought about a situation where the plantation owner could sit with his peers, observing the many people he had under his control at work. This not only facilitated labour, it also helped raise prestige for the plantation owner. Social status on 19th century Zanzibar was determined in no small part by client-patron relations. Enslaved labourers did not only function as labour, they were also understood to be clients, acting as vital followers who might even support their masters in fights with neighbouring plantation owners. Historical accounts of visits to plantations suggest that plantation owners manipulated such spaces to ensure that their visitors were able to see how many enslaved labourers they had present. Clove drying floors may also have been part of this visual arena of power, in which elites were demonstrating their status in relation to their enslaved clients. And this highlights the multiple genealogies of these plantations, drawing on varied conceptions of power from the multicultural milieu of which they were a part. So to conclude, historical archaeologists have viewed the landscapes of plantations in the Americas as tied to the development of capitalist spatial logics. These shifts mesh with the linear trend of rural landscapes from feudalism to agrarian capitalism that began in Europe. These forms of spatial control and ownership have also been linked to the development of the power of nation states and that of colonialism, where the spatial entities of states and bounded territories became the containers for political action. African contexts, however, figure into such developments only through the control of European powers. In the usual teleological discussions of space, European spatial and geographic hegemony develop through roots that are absent within indigenous histories of non-Western areas. African landscapes exist in forms radically different from those of the Western world, and this always already sense of difference and the understanding that European capitalism should penetrate all areas under colonial rule predicated the desire of the British officials to map out the islands. This desire was not located in a real need for maps to actually perform the work of economically developing plantation areas, for clove plantations were already productive. Maps were part of a broader colonial desire to know and to control in familiar ways using a particular apparatus of spatial regulation. Yet I hope I've also demonstrated that there were alternative forms of spatial control in operation within Omani and Swahili plantation spaces. Trees were owned and large areas of space were known and controlled within a system of production where crops were gathered to be sold into the capitalist world economy. To the eyes of surveyors such as Craster, the landscapes of Zanzibar were untenable as landscapes which fitted within the same system of capitalism that existed in rural Britain or the United States. Yet the production of these wild and untamed landscapes fed into market economies. Zanzibari clove plantations thus begin to emerge as geographical spaces which sit simultaneously within and outside of capitalism. The possibility that the history of capitalist landscapes is not as straightforward as the study of Europe and America alone is something we should take seriously. And in historical archaeology, we're perhaps guilty of a very old issue that Johann Fabian flagged up in Time and the Other many years ago. We tend to place capitalism in a more or less linear stream of development. But all spaces that exist at any one time are, in fact, coeval. And despite their inability to comprehend indigenous systems of land ownership, British and other European visitors in the 19th century were able to recognize the plantation on Zanzibar, an agrarian form which was, to their minds, wholly tied in to 19th century capitalist economies. So rather than placing different areas of the world in developmental frameworks of capitalism, I think the productive way forward for global historical archaeologies is to seize upon our ability to analyze coeval contexts. Through this understanding, we may produce more complex understandings of the past and the multifaceted ways in which cultural groups outside of the Atlantic world engaged with capitalism. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Okay, so before we have questions, we're going to hear some comments from our respondent tonight. Dr. Mandana Limbert is Associate Professor at Queen's College, CUNY, and also associated with the Graduate Centre. She received her PhD from Michigan in 2002. And we thought she'd be an excellent respondent. We know her from her work, 2010 Stanford publication in The Time of Oil, Piety, Memory and Social Life in an Omani Town. And she's currently working on a research project entitled Oman, Zanzibar and the Politics of Becoming Arab. So, Mani, if you would like to come and give us some comments before we open the floor to questions, please welcome Mandana Limbert, please.
Just a few comments on a great paper. Thank you, Sarah. So it's my great pleasure to serve as a discussant for this fascinating and provocative paper. Let me begin with a caveat. I should note that I'm not an archaeologist nor an expert of 19th century Zanzibar. I'm a historical anthropologist who's worked primarily in Oman, where I've been conducting research since 1993. I'm currently working on a project, as you heard, tracing early 20th century movement and the politics and implication of such movement between interior Oman and Zanzibar. I've also been fortunate to visit a few times. So let me begin by outlining some of the main themes of Sarah's paper and then raising some questions that I hope may serve as a platform for other questions. and for hearing from her more detail about her argument and material and more about the book in general, because I recognize this is just one chapter. At heart, this paper explores a fundamental tension between British colonial attempts in the late 19th and early 20th centuries at shaping Zanzibar into a successful capitalist economy and local property regimes that both undermined those attempts and were alternatively and unrecognizably to the British capitalist. Professor Croucher argues that this dissonance, my words, not hers, can be seen by the historical archaeologists in a number of ways. Let me outline these briefly and then ask a number of questions. First, she argues that we can see this dissonance through nomenclature. While British colonial officers insisted on using the term plantation with all of its Atlantic world associations, locals continued to use shamba, or in the Arabized broken plural version, shawanib, which is always interesting. Anyway, the different associations suggest for Croucher that the British insisted on seeing an agricultural world in a particular form. Second, she argues that British colonial administrators insisted on trying to implement the plantation's grid-like and panoptic spatial organization on seemingly non-gridded and non-panoptic local practices. At the same time, she points out, Omani plantation owners, or some in any case, did seem to organize their trees in rows and also placed their barazas next to the clove-drying spaces to watch, gaze upon their slaves at work. Croucher suggests that perhaps these Omanis were influenced by European landscapes in making grids. They may also have been interested in displaying their slaves as much as watching them. That is, they were European and not European. Third, she argues that the British colonial administrators were particularly keen to map and mark the territorial boundaries of properties, understanding that such organization and the title deeds that could be used to identify and prove land ownership would be necessary for successful capitalism. These administrators were, according to Croucher, confused by or unable to understand land tenure or property regimes whereby trees, rather than the land, were the primary focus of private property, and where mapping was hardly the basic organizational principle of land relations and management. On all three points, Croucher provides us with much to consider. Here are five questions and comments, three of which are directly about these points. Nomenclature. From my own examination at the Zanzibar National Archives, I found that British officials often used the term shamba instead of plantation, suggesting perhaps that they too recognized the variety of farms owned and operated by Omanis and non-Omanis. So my question is, was there a change in British attempts at labeling? Were some officers more open to the wide variety of shamba and others insistent on the plantation? Is it not interesting, too, that Omanis themselves picked up the Swahili word, shamba? Grids and gazes. While I am highly sympathetic to the revolution of scopic modernity, I wonder about those rows of trees on Abdallah bin Jaber's land. Do we have other examples of such farming? And I also couldn't help wondering about the closeness of the baraza to the clove sorting. Do we have other examples? Indeed, I couldn't help wondering whether it may also have been possible that the plantation owner would be involved in the labor. I ask because in my interviews with petty farmers in interior Oman, and granted, petty farmers rather than the large farm, recalling their lives in the 1950s in Moera, that's in interior Zanzibar, they would always describe, at least with copra, shucking it along with their workers. That is to say, I would love to hear more about how labor was organized spatial on these farms, where the supervisors fit in, because they're the ones who are engaged much more with their workers than anyone else, and whether there are other farms that provide a similar form. I don't know. Perhaps copra was different from cloves in the way labor was organized. So that would be another question. Third. This gets me to another question that I would like to raise that does not pertain directly to the dissonance outlined, and that is the category of Zanzibari presented here. How might we tease out this context of non-European colonialism? Who these Zanzibaris were? Are they Omanis? Aren't they? There were, of course, different waves, as you noted, and classes of Omanis moving to East Africa. And they were from different parts of what is now Oman, parts that were not at the time called Oman at all. Similarly, at times some Omanis, and often at different times, claimed to be Zanzibari and not Omani. So I'm just curious to know what this category of Zanzibari is that is counterposed to the British. If one of the aims of the paper was to blur the boundaries between European and colonized, certainly Omani elites and large landowners would provide that. However, here we often get the feeling that we have Europeans and Zanzibaris, Europeans and the colonized, with a few Omanis either influenced by Europe or sometimes also foreign to Zanzibar. Fourth, mapping and land. The obsession with mapping in the early 20th century and the concomitant confusion over land tenure that focuses on trees rather than land is very interesting. I found a fascinating map pertaining not to land tenure but to marriage registration in Zanzibar. That is, British officials at exactly the same period that you're looking at land tenure mapping were trying to organize marriage registration on the island. And like this story of land tenure, it was a bit of a fiasco. And one of the things an officer did was to make a map of where people needing to register their marriage should go. So they had this entire map of Zanzibar and every little district and people with all these arrows pointing in all these different directions about if you wanted to register your marriage, where you should go. And it was utterly confusing and it completely failed, but that's what they tried to do. This is simply to point out that this mapping fixation and the impulse to order and organize might have gone beyond, and I'm suggesting, gone beyond the desire for successful capitalism. Indeed, to my mind, for many of the officials, ordering and organizing in a particular way, and often through mapping, was as much about what a good and responsible colonial administration did as it was about capitalism per se. I would like to ask for how tensions of land tenure and property ownership may have played out beyond debates about mapping, but in legal cases and religious endowment records. I recognize that this is a bit unfair. This is not what the paper is about, but perhaps in other parts of the book, it's there. I wonder here whether it is in court cases where you have different interpretations, both Omani, non-Omani, of ownership and boundaries. It was fascinating to hear about the insistence on tree ownership and the insistence on boundary making without abstract maps, both of which, I should add, was highly familiar from interior Oman. But where land ownership, along with water time and individual tree ownership and many other forms of property could be bought, donated, sold, rented, auctioned, and inherited. But even more to the point, land boundaries in interior Oman have shifted very, very recently, to be described in abstract categories on maps rather than relative terms. So that's post-1970, 1980s politics. I wonder, however, how the divergent understandings of how property was envisioned could be seen through the lens of the law rather than through the maps. Finally, attention to law and courts, I was wondering, might also help us better understand how Islamic the Omani regime even understood or imagined itself to be. Whether before the British Protectorate Administration established itself or even after, because you use this term and I'm just curious about what that meant. So Sarah Croucher provides a fascinating reading of the tensions of colonialism on Zanzibar, not in its successes, but most importantly, through its failures and its misunderstandings.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Mandan. So if Sarah, do you want to respond to some of these directly, or shall we?
Do you want to take other questions?
Okay, so I'm going to field the questions tonight. Come and respond to one. Yeah.
So they're such interesting questions, and they've given me a lot to think about in some ways. And I think some of it is the interesting shift between an archaeologist who reads archives to understand about the material, and someone who is coming at the material in a different way. So I think one of the interesting points that you pull out, that's actually a major topic in my book, is this category of identification and this idea of who are Zanzibaris. And it's something that is definitely kind of skated over in this context. But one of the things that I think is really interesting in terms of material culture is the way in some ways that clove plantations disappear, especially in terms of Omani immigrants and enslaved laborers. There's kind of no material moment in which we see obviously kind of new immigrant populations coming in. And in terms of archaeology, this is always what we're looking for. And it's been a major theme of the archaeology of plantations in the U.S. is to try and look for evidence, in particular, for instance, of enslaved populations that we can kind of see traces of. And I think one of the things that happens on Zanzibar is this idea of this category of Zanzibari, this kind of shifting way of identifying oneself that's not as Omani, is not for enslaved populations as someone who is enslaved, but comes to be very much about a material identification with Zanzibar itself. And so some of the very few ways that we see Omanis at all is in some of the architecture on these plantations. But even then, it's kind of still very much a hybrid with local Swahili practices. And certainly in terms of the material culture that's being used in households themselves, the ceramics, the things that people are eating, there just seems to be this move towards adopting local Zanzibari practices. And I think certainly in the ways that people talk about past plantation populations, there was this real kind of turn towards becoming Zanzibari. I think what's interesting about these larger plantations, and this might speak to some of your questions about labor as well, is that here there seems to be more of a sense of difference. And so Abdallah bin Jabir is remembered as a kind of key figure. He's associated in with this plantation building. This building actually is still standing because there's such a kind of strong association with spirits with the building. And someone told me that someone who tried to rob stone from it had been killed. And I think in some ways also there is definitely something about the scale of plantations and the ways in which many of these plantations are certainly small and probably operate in quite different ways. But when you get to a plantation like this, there is perhaps more of a sense of difference around those spaces of labor, even though in some of the kinds of everyday practices, particularly in the household level, and I think this is something where some of the marriage practices are also important, and the role of concubines as well in the household. Some of these larger plantations seem to be important in having spaces in which labor and people actually are delineated in some ways. And there are certainly accounts of people who visit plantations in the mid-19th century, the 1860s, maybe the 1870s, where there's a real sense of kind of coming to these large plantations and the plantation owner greeting the visitors as kind of on their baraza, as having their laborers kind of laboring out there as a separate population. And so I think it's here that we see perhaps the moment at which that there is a difference, which on other plantation sites shades out, and yet always there's this kind of shift away from Omani necessarily as a fixed identity and into this kind of shifting category of Zanzibari that everyone from kind of both ends is tapping into in different ways.
Thank you, Sarah. Okay, as always, there's lots of questions, and so let's keep them short and to the point, okay? Okay, Peter.
Yeah, quick question. I'm curious in terms of the panopticon concept. Was there any evidence of resistance on the part of the slaves in terms of this vision, this gaze, just simply like rearranging their households so that they're less visible?
Yeah, well, their households don't seem to be within this gaze. So their households are actually very difficult to find, in part of the because of the materials that are used for them, and in part because of this problem that The enslaved population disappears materially. There's no easy way to identify them as different from other populations. But it seems that actually in terms of domestic spaces, mostly they're outside of this kind of gaze. There are historical accounts that seem to suggest that there was perhaps kind of idiosyncratic differences between different plantations. And yet for the most part, the way in which enslaved laborers' houses were related to the plantation owner's house doesn't seem to follow this kind of plan. So it's only in this labor space, and I think very much in this labor space in larger plantations, that we seem to have the shift towards kind of gathering things together in a central visual area.
That's somewhat different
than Caribbean. Oh, yeah, for
sure. Do you have any what you said that Omani, Islamic Omani Sultanate administration was better understanding implantation in Zanzibar than British. Yeah, this is my, I think this was your point of lecture, and of course the second lecturer estimate you and was a little different, yeah? And my question is, what, which administration and understanding knowledge or real situation of plantation in Zanzibar was better, colonial, means British colonial, or Omani Sultanate? And second question, second part
one
is about Zanzibar. What is the name? Today is Zambia?
No. Zanzibar.
Zanzibar?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think to ask which is better would better mean defining better.
A better understanding.
A better understanding?
Yeah. Doing a plantation. We have a man from Zanzibar. I think it's finished.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, the issue of the British is their failure to understand what's really going on. I think there's a interesting questions about this idea of what makes for the good colonial administration. And whether that I'm so interested in this idea of the map of where people go to get married. I can't wait to talk more about this. Of course, Bissell's work on kind of urban Zanzibar speaks to some of this as well. So I think it's so difficult to kind of speak to what is better. But I think the point that I want to make is that In the mid-19th century, these spaces are successful in terms of capitalist production. They're making large amounts of clothes. They're selling them out into a global market. And so if we wanted to speak of them in economic terms, then certainly we could speak of their success under the Omanis. I mean, the British aren't really running the plantations, so there's not the same kind of measure of success. And there's also changing economic conditions by the time the British come to power. But really, these plantations as a successful economic venture are driven by plantation owners, largely Omani, but also Swahili. Did that answer your question?
I'm curious if you discovered any tension around what we would call use rights, and that is to say access to construction materials, medicines, things that people could glean from the land that weren't the clove trees. Were there any domestic animals in this picture?
For sure there were some domestic animals around, and as far as I'm aware, they don't come up as in conflict. One of the interesting things is that enslaved laborers seem to have been really relatively quite free to have small holdings, and this is one of the tensions around the dissonances maybe around the abolition of slavery, in which many of the people who were enslaved don't want to be manumitted in the terms imposed upon them by the British, because the British idea is that they'll become wage labourers, go and work on plantations and lose many of their rights over land, their rights to have plots to build houses on, their rights to kind of be cared for in their old age. So I think in terms of rights on a plantation, some of these are about the kinds of the continuation of this client-patron obligation between a plantation owner and their enslaved population. One of the things that's interesting that didn't come up, and this may just be in terms of the areas that I chose to survey that were very much in the center of clove plantation areas, were tensions between previously existing Swahili farmers and planters coming in. And I think those certainly would have existed in some areas where you have lands that had already customary rights within them. However, this is some of, in archaeology, I would call it a sampling problem, right? Like, I was like, where are the areas where I'll find clove plantations? So I went, like, right in for the central areas. And these, I mean, it was certainly not a virgin forest, but these were not areas that were being farmed by other people. So the kinds of land rights get set up in many ways by plantation owners.
Just to follow up on the last question, do I understand correctly that it wasn't so important to the Mani plantation owners about the boundaries of the land, who owned the land? What was really important was who owned the tree.
Yeah.
That's so, it's very much like cattle in Sicily at one time. How many heads of cows do you have? How many steers do you have? Rather than the actual square meters of land.
Yeah, and I think here there's an interesting question, and it's actually something that I would be interested in kind of understanding more about the landscape, say, of Pangani on the mainland where they were growing sugar. Like, the very fact that cloves were a tree seems to have facilitated the fact that these plantation owners could come in and just take over large areas of land, because once they had these trees, they de facto kind of had ownership of the land, even though they didn't own it. And so I think there are interesting questions of, there are two other areas where plantations were in existence, controlled more by indigenous Swahili populations than Omanis, but Pangani in Tanzania, where sugar was being grown, in which the labor regime was also apparently more harsh, in part because of the nature of sugar. And then in Kenya, around Mombasa and Malindi, where grain was being grown. And it would be interesting in some ways to understand the nature of land ownership and control in those plantation areas, obviously also differing with the fact that they were owned generally by local elites rather than settler colonists for the most part. But to see how that difference between a kind of tree crop and grain and sugar also differed into kind of how landscape control was conceptualized.
The separation between land and trees is also characteristic of parts of Papua New Guinea, New Ireland, and New Britain. And an interesting contemporary example is in the Nilgiri Hills. The Todas, who you may remember, studied by rivers, owned the land, but they did not plant tea. They rent the land to tea people, to plantation owners who plant the tea trees and harvest the tea. They're not allowed to sell the land because they're tribal people. So you have that same separation of trees and land.
Flashing back to the debate in the U.S. about slavery, the profitability of slavery, I'm wondering if it's not in the nature of the plantation economy to engender a kind of ersatz feudal or world view that kind of plays back and prevents this kind of abstract, uniform, universal spatialization.
Yeah, I think though still there is something about the fact that, for me, and this argument is in part about historical archaeology and the way we think about how capitalism comes into being, and that there is this kind of progression that assumes that you need this conception of land as alienable and as a commodity to start to have certain forms of capitalist landscape. And I think what matters here is there's a clear awareness on the part of these plantation owners of what they're doing in terms of the broader scale of economic production. Yeah, and then what's happening on their plantations is not what's happening on a sugar plantation in the Caribbean, right? Certainly land is not alienated. Also, people are not alienated, right? That's really important. It's certainly something we could call more of a feudal system, for sure. And so I think it's also to, in some ways, kind of separate those things out and to think about what it means to kind of produce for global markets and how we can have kind of alternative logics of capitalism that exist in that same modern world system, right? I hesitate to use the words world system, but sometimes it's inescapable. But within that same world system, and yet at the same time, you know, there are alternative social systems that can exist that allow that same production to happen.
Like our most valuable land in the eastern part of the U.S., meets and bounds. I mean, you do a real estate deal today, meets and bounds, not the Northwest Ordinance abstract space. I mean, you can do it. You know, I think it's more cumbersome, but it still works for the world market.
Chris? Sarah, in the context you're talking about, you know, it's so complex, right? And I think that's what you're going to tell the world of historical archaeology, is that we've all simplified it way too much. But at the same time, what do you have to say about race in this sense?
So this is something I think that actually comes back to this point about being Zanzibari. What's interesting is, perhaps to back off from the Zanzibari point, is that the category of Arab in 19th century East Africa is one that people can adopt regardless of phenotype. It more depends on your ability to perform a certain category of identity. So in Western Tanzania, on these caravan routes, there are people who are clearly indigenous African elites who are claiming Arab status, sometimes through actual relations, sometimes by kind of broader affiliations, but they're dressing in the right way, they have the right form of material culture, not always, but often they're Arab, they're usually tied into kind of Swahili networks. And so there's also this sense of kind of who you are is not associated with what we would talk about as race, but other forms of difference. And also I think it's important to realize here that the concubine situation also means that you end up with freeborn children who can inherit, who can be the plantation owner, who are the child of a concubine, right? So the idea of racial difference is not bound up in the idea of slavery. Here instead it's about whether one is civilized, whether one can adopt proper Islamic cultural practice. And this is where some of the other material culture, where slavery kind of disappears, I think is about the process of resistance, right, where people are claiming their civilized status and in doing so are challenging their place in the kind of social hierarchy. And so here, you know, also slavery exists in a way that's kind of moving in some ways more towards chattel slavery, and yet the previously existing social system in which enslaved people can move up to become slave owners, can move up to become elites, certainly over a couple of generations can do so, means that there's not that same sense of difference. So I think I think there are then questions that can be drawn in about the way in which landscapes also encode racial difference in later plantations, that obviously then also needs to be built into this to talk about it wholly as capitalism is one thing, that are not to do with necessarily the alienation of land and the idea of the plan, but also as we start to get those plantation guides, what we're seeing in that idea of how the landscape should be laid out is also the beginning of the kind of spatiality of racial difference as well. So there's kind of those multi-layered factors going in. Does that answer your question?
No, we've got a question behind you.
This is an interesting, I mean, what interests me too is the clothes, based on what I've seen, you know, since the 1990s in the Comoros and Madagascar, is cuisine, race, class, and clothes. And I don't know, you know, I don't know how you can get at this, or obviously clothes are ephemeral. But I noticed in the Comoros, that there were dishes that used cloves, like pilau, like a rice dish.
Yeah.
Using
pilau that eat on Zanzibar too, yeah.
Right. But not in so much in the more remote villages where people were not claiming Shirazi or Arab heritage. And in Madagascar, in villages that cultivate cloves, which is a big cash crop, never used in any sort of as a spice at all in any cuisine. And sometimes people use it for toothaches, they said. And I wondered if in the historical, in the archival material you have, if there's any mention of cuisine or use of cloves.
So cloves are a little more difficult to tap into. What is important and really speaks to this with the pilau is rice. And actually, I think this is one piece with the ceramics that's important, is that really interestingly, ceramic patterns remained stable on the coast from the 17th century through to today, actually. Like, there are minor variations, but broadly they're the same. Part of their form is about cooking kind of rice-based dishes that fit with coastal cuisine. And in fact, ceramics are making a comeback for cooking rice. It's kind of, there's like whole ceramic industries going on. But one of the things that's clearly going on is that people are using Zanzibari cuisine as one of these routes through which they start claiming their identity as Zanzibari. And in fact, when I was talking to some more recent immigrants, they would talk about the fact that they kind of gave up eating ugali and they ate rice. And this was clearly a kind of marker of kind of making a real shift to becoming Zanzibari, was the move to eating rice-based foods in particular. And so it seems to be that this kind of cuisine that we see through ceramics in rural areas on Zanzibar is really kind of marked out as one way in which people are certainly changing what they're eating from areas they would have come from. Whether they're using cloves or not, who knows? But certainly they're using forms of coastal ceramics that must have been novel to many of these people. And yet they are, they have a long tradition that predates clove plantations, that predates this period of historical change, and it continues on throughout the 19th century.
Was this slave population that you referred to, with that label, which I think would be interesting to submit it to the same kind of hermeneutics that you submit the Omani category to, but was this slave labor population there, or was it imported during the period you're looking at, or what?
They were imported during this period. So,
during that period.
Yeah. And in fact, I mean, one of the things that happens is in the mid-19th century, as the British start to suppress the slave trade out from East Africa, you have an ever more concentrated slave trade from kind of central and east central Africa to the coast, that's then remaining on the coast as a laboring population rather than being sold out to other areas, although that slave trade still continues to some degree. And this, I mean, it's really difficult to understand the prehistory of the slave trade. It's definitely not something that archaeologically we have any kind of good take on. But really the 19th century sees a massive extensification of slave trading through the coast, and these people are being brought from inland areas to the coast newly in this period in massive numbers, like tens of thousands.
One of the things I wonder about with this tree crop thing, because what you're talking about, it sounds so similar to patterns that you see in coffee haciendas throughout the Caribbean and Central America, patterns that seem to be associated with cacao shrubs and quote plantation in Trinidad and other places like that. But I've always wondered what happens to a so-called enslaved population. They're so-called because there's layers and layers and layers of interpretations of what that category means. But from the perspective of those who have been enslaved, are brought to a place, labor there, and then their children become something else. And how much attention can we pay to that? I mean, how much can we help from that?
I think this comes back to this point of being Zanzibari, that really there is this amazing transformation that happens, that's continual, that's dynamic, in which people kind of re-identify locally. It's certainly a question that becomes of anthropological interest in the early 20th century, like who are the Waswahili? Later into the 20th century, where people are kind of continually re-identifying themselves with the East African coast. And I think in some ways this is a typical feature of this system, is that identity itself, kind of ethnic identity, is actually relatively fluid. And so status is one way through which people are identified at any given time, whether they're enslaved or whether they're free, but that status doesn't tie them in to a kind of eternal generation after generation identity. They can certainly move up and shift their position in the social scale.
Okay, I think we're out of time.
Yeah.
So I'd like to thank Mandala for taking the questions, and thank you to Sarah Croucher. And we'll see you all hopefully in September. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. That was great. Oh. Very well done.